Hello to our listeners. Welcome to the Women Governance Trailblazers podcast, where we listen to the journeys of trailblazing women in the corporate governance field, their passions, struggles, and commitment to improving how boards and companies function. My name is Liz Dunchy, and my co-host is Courtney Camlett.
Hi, everyone.
Courtney and I are both passionate about governance, and we want to spotlight some of the trailblazing women who share that passion. We love connecting with guests from different paths and industries to hear their perspectives on what surprised them in their career and where they think the field of corporate governance is going. And for this episode, we are delighted to be talking with Lucy Fato, who is Executive Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary of the New York City-based real estate and entertainment firm Seaport Entertainment Group, which is a recent spinoff from Howard Hughes Holdings and is now listed on the NYSE. Seaport's business ventures include mixed-use development at New York City's South Street Seaport and the Las Vegas Aviators baseball team. And before joining Seaport Entertainment in May of 2024, Lucy served in various leadership roles at AIG, which we'll discuss a little bit more during this interview. And prior to her time at AIG, Lucy has led many legal teams, including time as general counsel of McGraw-Hill Financial, which is now known as S&P Global Inc. And for 9 years prior to that, she served as deputy GC and corporate secretary of Marsh McLennan. Lucy began her legal career at Davis Polk & Wardwell, where she spent 14 years as a capital markets lawyer, including 5 as a partner in the firm's corporate department. Lucy is also very busy, and she serves on the advisory boards of Nardello & Co., a global private investigative firm, and of the Harvard Law School Center on the Legal Profession. She also sits on the board of directors of the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation, and she's a fellow of the American College of Governance Council. Lucy, we're thrilled to get to speak with you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited to talk with you. And wow, your resume is quite impressive and sounds like you are constantly very busy. Your experience is wide-ranging. At Seaport, you're general counsel of a newly standalone public company following a spinoff transaction. Prior to that, you were at the insurance company AIG, where you were executive vice president, general counsel, and global head of communications and government affairs beginning in 2017, and the vice chair 2023 and 2024. And you also spent a few years there as the interim chief human resources officer. You were also head of the Americas and general counsel of Nardello & Co., which is a global private investigative firm where you're still a member of the advisory board. We could go on because you've been in the field for over 30 years and have many other amazing accomplishments and experiences in both the for-profit and non-for-profit world. But we would love to hear about your career path in your own words and whether there's been anything that surprised you along the way.
Sure. Thanks, Courtney. I would say there have been many surprises along the way. I'm sure that doesn't come as a surprise. I started my career at Davis Polk. I had a very good experience there as a young associate in the 90s. It was a very significant period of growth, particularly in equity capital markets, which is what I focused on. And after I made partner in 2000, I thought I would stay at Davis Polk, which is, I think, what most people think when they make partner after working hard for 8, 9 years. But a few years into the partnership, I had an opportunity that became available to go in-house at Marsh McLennan. And I actually found the opportunity more intriguing than I thought I would. And so I decided to make the leap. I was single at the time. I didn't have children, so I had a lot of flexibility in terms of what I did and how I spent my time. And I never really looked back once I went in-house, and that led to other opportunities down the road. I think what surprised me the most is that I essentially became a lawyer that was always involved with companies that had gone through regulatory problems and were trying to get back on their feet. Sometimes I realized that going in, sometimes I didn't, but that always seemed to be a common theme throughout my career. And so I became a bit of a problem solver and a change agent than I think I had ever expected, having come from a firm like Davis Polk, where there's a lot of continuity, a lot of history. Really, no surprises, to be perfectly honest, in terms of the firm and the kind of work that you did. And so when I went in-house, that just changed a lot. And there was a lot of turnover in C-suites, different CEOs, board turnover, and that was the case throughout my entire, in-house career. It's a little different now. I'm at a smaller company. We were just spun off, so we're newly public. So there's a bit more stability right now. It's still early days for us as a public company, but I think going into very large corporations, I was surprised by how much change there can be in these large organizations that you think have been, pretty stable for decades. And then it takes one sort of bad regulatory incident and suddenly all that goes away. And it often takes time for these companies to get back on their feet.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I have a similar path where I was at the SEC and started in a law firm and then went in-house. And from the in-house perspective, you really do get more of the strategic view. So being a change agent is really a value add to the team. And that way, you have different lenses with which to advise.
Completely agree. Yes, I think as lawyers, you always have to be looking around corners, anticipating what issues there may be, keeping an eye on the changing regulatory landscape, and just thinking back over my career, how much has changed at the SEC, disclosure rules, put aside any other specific regulatory regime you fall under, depending on the industry that you're in. There's just always change. There are always new people coming. People taking a fresh look at things, priorities shift, stakeholders have different views and interests. And I think as lawyers, we have to be able to sort of adapt quickly and also anticipate what may be coming down the pike so that companies can be prepared and not caught off guard.
We are in a time of great and quick regulatory change, unlike any that I remember previously. So agility
Looking
in-house is
for it
key.
right now. And I think
Yes.
too, we'll talk more about some of your other roles, Lucy, but keeping a cool head under pressure and not getting your feathers ruffled during some of these changes is also, it seems like, such an important trait for a GC because I haven't been in-house in a legal role, but I've been inside a company in a business role. And, it affects people when there's change. And so to have somebody in a leadership role who's able to stay calm and kind of guide the ship is just so important.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. Although there are times where sometimes you have to take a stand too. You can't just kind of go with the flow or, just stand by if there are things going on that you don't think are appropriate, or if you think people just aren't quite understanding the significance of a particular issue or a particular regulatory problem. And having cleaned up many regulatory problems, it's always been my goal to try to avoid them because I see the damage that is done. And sometimes it's recoverable, sometimes it's not. And even when companies do recover, oftentimes they're never the same. And so it's can be a real shock to the system when you have something significant happen at a large corporation that's been around for a long time. That's sort of that was sort of a common theme in all of my in-house jobs, where they were companies that had been around for a very long time. They had very strong brands. Then something happened that was damaged, and it takes time to recover. And sometimes you need different leadership. Sometimes you need to change out people on the board in order to make change. And, every company is different, but the status quo usually doesn't work when you've had something significant happen that really goes to the core of what the company is about or what it does day to day.
Such an important perspective. So you mentioned making the leap to Marsh McLennan from Davis Polk. And as you said, it's somewhat rare for someone to leave a law firm once they're a partner, especially a firm like Davis Polk. Could you say more about the factors that prompted you to make the shift from private practice to an in-house career at that particular point in time? And are there things that you wish you would have known as you're considering that decision or making the transition? And then, as I alluded to, you've been in other roles too, legal adjacent roles, like Courtney said, HR, communications. Do you have advice for people who are considering maybe those types of roles, or are there certain experiences that are critical for people to get?
Yes. So in terms of the decision to go to Marsh McLennan, there were a couple of unique factors that I think influenced my decision, or actually didn't make it that difficult of a decision. One is I knew the general counsel that I was going to be working with. And the other thing that surprised people when I made this move is I went to Marsh McLennan as the deputy general counsel and the corporate secretary to the board. I did not go in as the general counsel. And a lot of people really thought that was odd. Why would you leave a Davis Polk partnership to go and be a number two lawyer? But I had never worked in a corporation before, let alone a big corporation. And Marsh McLennan was a very significant corporation, very large, very global, a lot of diverse businesses. It was in brokerage, insurance brokerage, reinsurance brokerage, consulting. We also owned Putnam and Kroll when I went there. So it was really a very significant conglomerate and very global in nature. And so that was all very appealing to me. But knowing the general counsel personally was also important because I knew what I was going into. I knew who I'd be working for. There wouldn't weren't really going to be any surprises there. And he was someone who I trusted and had known for a long time. And so we really did sort of divide and conquer. He had a litigation background. He had been brought in with the Spitzer, Elliott Spitzer matter when he went after the insurance industry. And he had been brought in to resolve that and then deal with all the fallout from that from a regulatory standpoint afterwards. And I was really brought in as a corporate lawyer to help with the fundamentals of the business, work on board and board governance matters, which were starting to come to the forefront at that point. This was back in 2005, post Sarbanes-Oxley, but pre a lot of other things that happened. So there was more of a focus on corporate governance generally, board composition, all the things people sort of take for granted today. They were really just starting to emerge as bigger issues back then. And so that was appealing to me too. It was really sort of let's divide and conquer this, all the things that we have in front of us. And also the management aspect of the job turned out to be more interesting than I thought it would be. Overseeing lawyers in lots of different groups, not just being in charge of the SEC filings and the board work, but it was also employment law. It was also M&A. It was a lot of other areas that I didn't really practice in as a capital markets lawyer. I mean, I touched lots of different areas, but my expertise was in capital markets, and that was what my main focus had been. So it was really interesting to be able to expand the work that I did, the areas that I oversaw, and learning about budgets and budgeting and outside counsel relationships. And really, the business of running a law firm, because it is like running a business unit, especially when you go into a company that has significant legal spend and finding ways to get that right sized and start to get more to a normal run rate as a lot of issues get put behind you. So that was all really interesting. And then, even at Marsh McLennan, there were periods where I took on communications for a while. I always thought it was interesting, looking back at how people always gave me other things to do, even if they were just temporary, like interim this or interim that, until we found the right person to slot in. And I really took that as a compliment. I thought people viewed me as more than just a lawyer. They viewed me as someone who was a good listener, a good writer. I had good judgment. And, when you work with a board, which is one of the things I love about the corporate secretary role, and the work that a corporate secretary does, whether I'm doing it myself or whether I'm overseeing someone in that role, is you really get a window into everything going on in an organization. And so you see, I've always worked very closely with finance people. As a corporate lawyer, that's just kind of the way it goes. You sort of are joined at the hip with people in finance all the time, for better or for worse. I happen to love finance people, but
Depends how they're doing, right?
And look, I was a business and economics major
Yeah, me too.
undergrad. And I actually had applied to get a joint JD MBA. And then I ended up just getting the JD because I like law school so much. So I think that sort of core inside of me of being a business oriented person, stayed with me even after I became a lawyer. I think it's why I became a corporate lawyer, not a litigator. I just think I was always drawn to the business side. And so my training at Davis Polk, I think, was very good in helping me think through, like, how do you help a business grow? We were trying to raise money, and what were you raising money for? And what was the strategy, and how would it be spent? And describing that in a prospectus and trying to get people interested in a company. So if you're too heavy-handed on the legal stuff, people are going to lose interest pretty fast. So yes, you had to do the risk factors and all those other things, but you had to be able to focus on what was the core of the business and how do you sell that to investors in the street with credibility and backing it up with a lot of diligence and that sort of thing. So I've always been, I think communications was always something I was attracted to. I think communications are key to everything, whether you're a lawyer or a finance person or a business person or an HR person. If you can't communicate what you're trying to do and why, it's going to be hard to bring people along. And so, and especially in corporations, and when you're speaking to stakeholders like shareholders or regulators, it's really storytelling at the end of the day. And that's what a prospectus was. I worked on tons of IPOs. I was really lucky. I worked on a lot of really fun IPOs. Taking a company public for the first time is, it can be once in a lifetime for management teams, not necessarily for the lawyers and bankers that do all the deals, but for the management teams, it's a big deal. And being able to tell their story is critical. And so that's really what I had been trained to do, was to tell stories and then make sure that all the legal safeguards were in the document as well to protect people, protect the underwriters, protect the company, its board. But if you can't tell your story, it's like anything. It doesn't matter what you do for a living. If you aren't able to capture people's hearts and minds, so to speak, you're just not really going to be successful, regardless of what you're trying to do. And especially if you're trying to affect change, then it really becomes important. So I think as a lawyer, I was always asked to review press releases and other communications just to make sure we weren't saying anything that was inaccurate or wasn't consistent with what we had previously said. I was always involved in earnings calls and making sure that things were presented appropriately, that people were prepped to answer questions that might come up so that there were no surprises. And so, the communication stuff just came very naturally to me. And I view communications as very strategic. And so, as I got more and more senior in my career, I liked being involved in communications more and more because I understood the importance of being able to communicate effectively to all of your stakeholders. And similarly with HR, I can't say I ever had a strong desire to be an HR person. And I'm hopefully that is sort of in my past. But when I had to do it, I was able to step up and do it. And again, communications is critical in an HR job. I mean, there you're focused on your employees that are an incredibly important asset in most businesses, certainly. All the businesses I've worked in have been about the people. Financial services is very much about the quality of the people. Now I'm in hospitality, food and beverage, sports, entertainment. The people are really important here at Seaport Entertainment Group as well. And HR issues are critical, especially in this day and age, given everything going on. Being able to communicate to your employee base, help people understand what situations look like and why. A lot of change in my new job. Even though we're a small company, we've undergone significant change, starting with the spinoff and everything that's been happening since then. And we're a growth-oriented company, which means we're hoping to grow and grow quickly, which means there will be more and more change coming. And so it all kind of comes together. So it doesn't surprise me when I look back that people came to me and said, will you step in and do this on an interim basis? Frankly, I think it just made people's lives easier to have someone there that people knew just to kind of keep it going until we found the right person. So I think being flexible and being able to adapt and do other things is important, even if it's not something you're going to do long term. So I'm glad I did all those other roles, particularly communications. As I said, I'm always involved in communications, whether I run it or not. It's just the nature of being a lawyer, I think. And HR was a good experience. I think looking at everything through the lens of your employee base is a good thing to do. And so I'm much more sensitive to those issues now than I was before. I was always more externally focused on shareholders, regulators, government agencies. So doing that work on the HR front was a good experience because it made me recognize that you have to communicate differently internally. You want it to be the same. You can't be telling different stories internally and externally, but there are different ways to do it that some are more effective than others. And then I also had the great pleasure of doing all these roles during COVID, which was just, a very different experience and one I hope not to repeat ever. And
About adaptability.
yes. Yeah.
Well, wearing all these different hats really helped prepare you for the general counsel role. And I know that as a corporate secretary, I think people underestimate the impact and strategic focus that that role has, especially when dealing with the board, because you've got to understand the company. You've got to be able to strategically communicate both internally and to the board. So I think that's all very important. The other piece of that is sort of an ethics and compliance role as a general counsel. In your experience, are there behaviors or actions that allow general counsels to support a culture of ethics and compliance while still also being seen as a valuable business partner? And how do you recommend handling situations where executives view noncompliance with laws as a calculated business risk?
It's a great question. I always tell people that when I was the corporate secretary at Marsh McLennan, it was one of the best jobs I ever had. We had a fabulous board. They had gone through a couple of really bad situations. There had been a regulatory issue with Putnam. Then you had the Elliott Spitzer matter in insurance on the insurance side. Later, we had a big litigation matter in Mercer we had to deal with. And so this was a board that had seen a lot, and they had learned the importance of tone at the top. And it was just an incredibly impressive group of people. And they were so supportive of me as the corporate secretary. It was a role that was really valued. And we worked really hard in my first couple of years in particular to get the board back on a good footing, back to a regular cadence of meeting. Because what happens when you're in a crisis is you're just meeting all the time and it's hard. You can get really derailed in terms of what you focus on, how much time you spend it on. And sometimes, getting a company and a board to refocus and reestablish some kind of normal cadence can be tough. Because when boards have to come in and deal with these things, they're so hands-on that sometimes it's hard for them to then take a step back and say, okay, now we need to take a step back. The crisis is over. Maybe we've brought a new management team in, maybe not, or we've made other changes. And so that's where I think a corporate secretary can be really helpful. But for me, I had an excellent board, and they actually taught me about what good governance looked like. And as we brought new people in at Marsh McLennan, and there was a lot of change in my first 2, 3 years, we turned over every operating company. The management teams turned over at least once, if not twice. Some were just retirements, but others were not. And the board was the common thread, and they really stood firm and made sure that the people coming in understood the history. They didn't want to get bogged down in the history, but they didn't want to hear this, oh, that's behind us, we're moving on. No, you don't want to forget about the past because then you'll repeat the errors of the past. And so they were very, very good in being that steady presence in the company when there was all this other turmoil and chaos going on. And so that was a really great experience for me. I ended up staying 9 years. We added, I think, 8 new directors during my tenure at Marsh McLennan. I was involved in all of those searches. I was involved in succession planning, really as the board's person. I was. And in some ways, I was fortunate there. I was not on the executive team because I was the deputy GC. I was not the general counsel of the company. And it gave me some distance. And I actually had, I would say, a fair amount of independence in that role, which the board helped me with. And they helped me maintain that independence from everything else going on in the company. And so I was really grateful for that. And to this day, I feel that that board I inherited at Marsh McLennan was, one of the best boards I've ever worked with in my career in terms of just the diversity on the board, the different experiences people had had. It was very collegial. They all really stood by each other and supported each other through some really, really tough times. And so I learned a lot. And they also trusted me to be the face of the company with shareholders. I would run all the annual meetings. We had lots of shareholder proposals. I would do a lot of engagement in the off season and built a lot of great relationships. And that's what it took to build back, trust from that group. And that was also an era when a lot of these corporate governance things we sort of take for granted now were really just starting to emerge. And so we wanted to be at the forefront of Marsh McLennan in terms of a lot of those types of things. I got involved with the NACD, National Association of Corporate Directors, where there were great education opportunities, there. And so I really just got exposed to a lot of things that touched public company directors that really drew me in, and governance became an area that I really enjoyed working on and being a part of that community. I really enjoyed being a part of that community back then.
Yeah, well, we enjoy it too, having this podcast on corporate
Great.
governance trailblazing.
It's a great world. It is great people. Everybody
Yeah.
wants to do the right thing, whatever's right. There's no one size fits all. That's the other thing I tell people. I hate these check the box exercises now. And I have to tell you, I sort of came full circle on governance. Now at Seaport, we have an excellent board too. I tell people here all the time, we are so lucky. We have an amazing board. It's small, but
Huge
everybody's
difference.
got great experience. They come from different parts of all the things that we, different areas that we touch as a business. They have a lot of experience both in business and on other boards, which I think is really critical that people see what other companies do and how they do it. And so they bring all that experience to bear. And especially for a newly public company, I find their support incredibly, incredibly helpful. So I'm very, very grateful that I've joined a company that even before I got here understood the importance of having really great directors and people that are very engaged and willing to roll up their sleeves. But I will say I got very frustrated, in the latter part of my career with a lot of these check the box exercises with proxy advisory firms and even some of the governance groups within some of the big institutional shareholders. I would argue with people that I had met when I was at Marsh McLennan and had built relationships with and had known them for years and would talk to them every year, year in, year out. What are the issues? What's top of mind? And then all of a sudden, I found myself sort of banging heads with these people. And I was like, what happened to you people? You used to like think about things and have conversations and realize there's no one size fits all. And companies are in different stages of, where they are and what they're doing and what needs to be done and, say on pay, just out of control and everyone just saying no for the sake of saying no. And I got incredibly frustrated with the governance community. And now I'm trying to get sort of back into it a little bit here at Seaport because I am the corporate secretary. But I've been very cautious because, like I said, I'm not a fan of check the box exercises and I don't believe in that. And when you've got, especially someone like me who's been doing this for 30 plus years, taking the time to talk people through, for people to not even give you the benefit of the doubt after 30 years, it's like, really? Like, what happened to you? And so that's not good governance. Checking boxes is not good governance. I think people went way overboard with all their own guidelines and what they had to do. And then it became about them and not even about you. Well, we have to comply with our own guidelines because we can't explain why we're going to make an exception. Like, I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry. I don't understand. I don't speak your language anymore. I don't understand what you're talking about. That's not good governance. Governance is, bespoke, and companies need to do what they need to do. And in different parts of their life cycles, they've got different priorities. And so it was very disappointing. And so I'm hoping we'll come out of that now with all this disruption that's going on and people sort of throwing playbooks in the garbage and, starting all over again. Because I feel like, and I hate to say this because I'm a governance person at heart, but I feel like the field lost its way for a little bit, and we need to kind of get back on track and do what we do best, which is to exercise really, really good judgment and always do what we think is in the best interests of the company and its stakeholders.
I feel like Liz and I could have a whole separate series of podcasts about that type of frustration, focusing more on the importance of strategic governance.
Yes, exactly. And like I said, there's no one size fits all. And companies may do something one way and then they may shift and do it in a different way because the business is changing or the environment is changing or the colleague base is changing. COVID's a great example of that, and remote work and shifting to that and, retaining people and other considerations. And so when you move away from that, I feel like anybody can do it. Like if, you And that's not
AI could
fun,
do it. Yeah. Yeah.
right?
I
You
think.
want to like you want to have people that are thinking and talking and evaluating things and trying to get to the right place. And it may just look different sometimes from how it looked in the past or how it may look in the future. And to not be accommodating for silly reasons. That's, like I said, a check the box exercise. Or places boxing themselves in with their own silly policies that they can't deviate from. It just kind of denigrated the field, I thought. So
Yeah.
I'm hoping a lot of that is going to go by the wayside and people will exercise better judgment when it comes to governance.
I appreciate that viewpoint, and I'm so glad that you shared that. It's an important perspective, and I think, quote unquote, best practices became sort of a shortcut for people to follow without having to exercise that judgment. And I'm sure there are a lot of contributing factors to that, but I too am happy to see that we're getting more back to basics and back to understanding that this really is a profession where difficult judgments are required and there isn't always clear or correct answer. So, it's something I think that we need to self-examine ourselves and talk more about too. So I'm really happy that you shared that.
I completely agree with that. And, for better or worse, I have been practicing now for over 30 years, which kind of stuns me every time I say that. But, having been around before governance even really emerged as a
Yeah.
thing and seeing how it's evolved, I think it's mostly quite good and a positive for a corporation, but you can definitely get sideways very, very easily. And then people just kind of miss the point altogether. And then you're just sending weird mixed messages to people and none of it makes any sense. And then people just get frustrated and throw their hands up. And so I, like I said, I think things went a little bit overboard and I'm hoping they start to come back.
Yeah, and I loved what you said too in the context of the business scenario of you need to know your history and use that to learn lessons and avoid making the same mistake more than once. But at the same time, you can't get bogged down in it either. And so I think, that's so important to keep in mind. And looking ahead with all of, this 30 years of experience that you have in the field, what do you see as the biggest issues that are coming down the pike that we in the corporate governance field need to be thinking about in light of, as we mentioned earlier, all of the disruption that's going on in the wider world with geopolitics and artificial intelligence and everything?
Yeah, look, I think, and you both said this earlier, I think in the corporate governance world, certainly in the boardroom and also with management teams, I think being very steady during times like this, being open-minded and listening, that doesn't mean you accept all the craziness that's going on. And, it doesn't mean you don't draw the line on certain things. I think some things that are happening are a bit extreme, and hopefully that will dissipate over time. I think some people like shock value, but that kind of gets old after a little while. So I'm kind of hoping some of this stuff gets old. But I think you need to be somewhat dispassionate about it and really just stay focused on what your core values are as an organization. What do? What is your business strategy? What industries are you in? What need are you filling? And don't get distracted by all the other things that aren't relevant to that. Because again, when you sort of get into these check the box exercises, companies start talking about things, they have policies they put in place, And you're like, well, what does that have to do with the business that you're in? You know, is it just, are you just looking for a headline, or do you want to just be on a certain panel, or does your CEO want to be talking at, some certain organization? Like, what's the point of it if it's not relevant to what you do as a business? I think you have to think hard about whether you want to just be jumping on the bandwagon for the sake of, being part of a conversation that may not really have anything to do with what your strategy is, or, what your core business is. So I think you kind of have to get, again, like, get back to basics. Like, what is your company? What do you want to be? What do you want to be known for? What's your value add? How do you distinguish yourself from your peers? And then everything else kind of falls into place from there. And if you're looking at things strategically at all times, every decision should be a strategic decision, really. I mean, when it comes to anything that you're talking to your shareholders about or your regulators about, and sometimes they're at odds with each other. That happens a lot too. But I think anytime you try to just go down a path because everybody else is doing something or saying something, I think that's when you can get yourself in trouble. So I always tell people, as a lawyer, sometimes you have to stand alone, which is not fun. But I think that goes for organizations as well. Like, you can't just fall along and do what other people are doing. Sometimes you just have to say, you know what, that just is not relevant to what we do, or it's not something that's going to drive our business or drive our strategy. And so it's just not an area of focus for us. It may be an area of focus for other people, but it's not for us at this moment. And I also think you have to be careful to not put any one stakeholder in front of another. Sometimes people do too much for shareholders versus regulators, or they're more external than they are internal. And then their employees get disgruntled and unhappy, and that creates other issues. And so I think you have to be really careful to think about all of your stakeholders and not just one or two at the expense of the others.
Yeah, and
So
to your
it's challenging.
communication point earlier, to think through whether or not you're going to do something, coming to an actual decision about it, and how you're going to communicate either doing nothing or doing the thing, and being able to pressure test that in advance of, external pressure to make
Right.
it on something. Like it goes back to what you were saying earlier about communications.
Yeah. And look, you have to be really thoughtful, especially if you're going to take a position on something that's a hot button issue or that's getting a lot of attention. You really have to think through, like, is this going to work for us over time? Because the last thing you want to do is commit to something and then say, oh, our mistake, and then move away from it. You see a lot of this with return to work. A lot of companies have been going back and forth. Can people come 3 days or 4 days or 5 days? And after a while, they just look silly. It's like you just sit there and you're like, why are they making such a big deal out of this? Not every person is going in 5 days a week. So, like, why are you making such a big deal out of this 5 day a week thing? Like, I'm sure there are people all the time, like, even pre-COVID, there were people who didn't go to an office on Friday and worked from home. And I remember a thing called Summer Fridays where we would give people either Friday off or it would be a half day. And so people have always made accommodations around people's schedules. And so suddenly it just became this thing, and everybody's now talking about 5 days a week in the office. And I'm like, that's weird. When I was a young lawyer, it was like 6 days in the office, sometimes seven. And so it was, five would have been a gift. But that shows how old I am. That was, before we even had email and voicemail and things like that. And so I find some of these things kind of funny that people make such a big deal and it gets so much CEO level attention. It's like, wow, your CEO has time to focus on that. Lucky you. Like, you clearly don't have anything else going on of, much importance if that's the big topic of the day. Like, how many times do you have to say it? Stop.
Okay, so for our last question, this is one that we ask all of our guests, and that is, what do you think women in the corporate governance field can add to the current conversation on the societal role of companies, which we kind of talked about, but do you think that anyone has a unique perspective on that?
I'm obviously a big fan of women in the governance field and women in the legal profession. And I've spent a lot of time over the course of my career mentoring everyone, really, not just women, but lots of different people from different walks of life. And and not even just in the legal profession, frankly, and especially younger generations in particular, who I think, you know, so much has changed in the last 5, 10 years. It's kind of hard sometimes for younger people to figure out where their place is or what's a good career path or how do they build the right kinds of relationships. But, you know, I do think it's important to have women at the table on these issues. I do think women approach things differently, think about things differently, and build different kinds of relationships. And so I think it's a field that has attracted a lot of women over the years. And I attribute that to it being interesting. I mean, it's an interesting area. I love working with boards. I like the work that boards do. And I've watched boards evolve and change over the years and add more women and add more diversity in other ways. And again, I was never a fan of check the box exercises with boards either. You know, there are a lot of people who do not appear to be diverse on their face, but they are. So I think people underestimate diversity in that way. And you need critical skill sets on a board. And sometimes they can show up in places that you wouldn't expect. And I like the fact that directors are getting younger in a lot of organizations. I think that's a really good change. Historically, directors tended to be older. They tended to be retired. They tended to have more time available. Whereas now, I think for sitting executives to go on a board, it's not as unusual. And I think that's a good thing as well. I think it's good for executives to see how boards operate and what they do, because there was always a lot of mystery around boards in the boardroom and what goes on in a boardroom. And, you know, I don't think there needs to be that much mystery to it. Obviously, you don't want to be talking about what a board is looking at and discussing, but generally speaking, you know, there's some basic things all companies need to do and all boards need to do. And so I think bringing in different perspectives, and especially with younger people who are more active day to day in the business world, I think is a good shift, whether it's male or female. But yeah, I mean, do I wish there were more women on boards and more women in the C-suite and more women as CEOs? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's a good thing to be seeing the shift towards cognitive diversity and diversity of experience being the heavier emphasis versus demographic diversity. I too like to avoid check the box exercises, but I think we were kind of using that as a proxy for the cognitive diversity. And so
right.
We can continue to bring in those varied experiences and perspectives and make the businesses better. I mean, that's the ultimate goal. So
yeah, look, we live in a very diverse world. I always tell people, if you don't, you have to work hard not to have diversity. I mean, it's just the workforce is just much more diverse than it used to be. So if you don't have diversity, whether it's on your board or in your C-suite or just within your employee base, you know, something's not right, because that's just not the way the workforce looks nowadays. So I always find that interesting. When you do look at places and you're like, really? Like, how did you get that group of people together? Like, that statistically, that's like not possible. So I think it should just be the default, right? And then if you don't have diversity, it's like, why? Why does everybody look the same? Or why don't we have more gender diversity? Why don't we have more people from different age groups? That's what I think the focus should be on, is when you don't have it. But I think there's more diversity out there than people think. And while it may not always be obvious on its face, I think there is a lot more diversity out there than people think.
Yeah. Well, that was a very insightful response to our question. And Lucy, we're so glad that you could join us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was great. Really nice talking with you both.
Absolutely. And for those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Please subscribe to Women Governance Trailblazers on whatever platform you use for podcasts. We'd love if you'd rate us while you're there. And in addition, if anyone out there knows a Women Governance Trailblazer who you think would be a great guest on this show, Feel free to ping Courtney or me on either LinkedIn or by email. Thanks, everyone.